Philosophers. Well, this was kind of a hot start here because we pretty much launched into, I think, a topic before we started recording. So let's kind of rewind it for a second.
Right. So the context about this subject has to do with the history of the trial of King Charles I of England. For those who do not know the history behind that, the thing that got us talking about this was a lovely channel on YouTube called Historia Civilis. And he has done, I think he did only one video leading up to it, and then the actual video of the trial itself.
But most of his content is pretty fantastic. Like, he does an excellent job of explaining things, and his series on Rome is phenomenal, and it's a great way to spend days of watching YouTube.
I was going to say, if you would like to spend an entire weekend getting smarter.
Yeah, definitely check him out.
Yes.
So, anyway,
yeah, Charles the First. Basically, long story, very short, and you should still watch the history. Charles the First was responsible for a civil uprising in England, which resulted in him deploying the army against his own people and killing thousands of them, and also arresting political opponents, and I believe that they died. They were either put to death or died in prison for merely expressing dissent.
You can just sum it up into doing tyrannical things.
Right. So then this led to his trial, but the problem was that his trial, the trial had no legal authority on which to stand, because it only passed the House of Commons in Parliament, but not the House of Lords, and so it was an illegitimate court.
Right. Well, and even then, in that time, the king had, the monarchy still had the authority to overrule Parliament. Essentially, this is after, you know, Magna Carta and all that, where and the British Parliament had been established, but the House of Commons represented and voted on by the people, and the House of Lords, which were mainly appointed by the king or who owned counties. So you had that system set up, and they could create laws and pass laws and approve them, but everything still had to get rubber stamped by the monarchy, much more so than it does today. The king could actually just veto and do whatever he wanted under...
Right, Parliament was more of a suggestion.
Exactly. So this is the first time that Parliament, well, not even all of Parliament, just the House of Commons decided that it was going to do something separate and defy the king and the House of Lords.
Right, and try the king or put charges against the king that technically could not apply to a king.
Right.
Like treason. Because the legal definition of treason at this time was taking up arms against the king. Well, the king didn't do that.
Right.
So it's technically not treason.
And there are some legal, the legal way they tried to explain it is that taking arms against the crown, and if the crown gets its authority from Parliament, the Parliament gets its authority from the people. So the crown taking up arms against its people is essentially the crown taking up arms against itself.
Right.
So
basically, they came up with roundabout ways for arguing for these things to basically give as much justification as they felt necessary for getting rid of the king.
Right. And this is one of the first examples of popular sovereignty rearing its head, in that it was a populist movement to do this. And just to lay a little bit more groundwork, this is the during the English Civil War. Well, one of the English Civil Wars, but this is the one that involved, like, Oliver Cromwell. You know, that's a name that most people might recognize. So they had already arrested him, and he was being held in jail at this point, because the peasants that had risen up had now taken control. And so they're coming up with this trial to try to try the king. And that this is just all, like, leading up to what we're talking about. The thing that really make this stick out to us, or to me, and I'm pretty sure to you, is when the king arrives and is being arraigned effectively, you know, where they tell him what he's being charged with and ask him how he pleads, he refuses to enter a plea.
He just, right. The first thing he does is question the legitimacy of the court.
Exactly. And they know that, and there has already been a bunch of discussion by these members of the House of Commons, that they don't have a legitimate reason. They're trying to come up with one to answer that question before this all went down, and the whole thing just goes kangaroo for the next couple of days in this trial, and it's just a repeat of Parliament telling him he's been charged and he needs to enter a plea,
And him saying, what authority do you have to charge me?
And it just keeps going back and forth like that until he... Well, also this time, you could be held in contempt of parliament, which is... Or contempt of court.
Contempt of court.
In which, at this time, the trial could go on without you.
The distinction of contempt of court is that the defendant is removed from the courtroom and the trial proceeds without the defendant's input.
Right. And so they ended up doing that and then convicting him and sentencing him to death. So how did you put it? Like, how did you put it a minute ago? Where people realize that...
Right. So it came across to me that this was a moment where for at least an instant, although it didn't stick with them, apparently, people realized that legal authority is not legitimate in the first place. Because something had happened that everyone there agreed was wrong. That the king had turned on his own people and had to be removed. But there was no legal framework by which they could actually remove him. And so realizing that that was completely unjust, they just overrode the law by force.
Right. And this kind of led to, I guess, our conclusion that there really isn't such a thing as legal authority. It's more, I see it personally as more of an excuse for doing, it's a justification for
right.
what you're doing, but
it's a facade of legitimacy.
Yeah, it's a facade of legitimacy. Because just because you write something down on a piece of paper doesn't mean that it's true or that it imbues you with authority. But that's kind of, but if you look at how things have turned out now, this was hundreds of years ago at this point.
Yes.
Yeah. Hundreds of years ago. It was the same, but it's not really changed much today. You know, when you look at the laws that are written, they're just a way of telling you what people will come and kill you for. But the authority that it imbues on those to carry out those laws comes from nowhere. Except in this case, it was the fact that you want a war and you have the army. You have the force to do what you want to do.
Right.
And in this case, even when and this is an excellent chance to show that it doesn't matter if you have the force, you can fall back on principles and not use that force, but they use the force anyway. Wow, that sounds like a stupid Star Wars quote. But it's no different today. You know, when you look at the laws laid out by, you know, say the United States, those are just words on a piece of paper that a bunch of people that had an army that had just won a war
wrote down.
And not even that. It's a bunch of people who won a war and then wrote down some laws, realized that it didn't give them enough authority to do anything. You know, if you look at the Articles of Confederation.
Right. The Articles of Confederation are the real United States government.
It is. And then the same people who happened to make that government didn't like it, sans a few people, and they just undid it. And
right. They just decided, okay, well, we're going with this now, and we'll call it the Constitution.
Right. And everyone kind of goes along with it because... What you going to do? You know, the average everyday person at that time especially wasn't aware that this even happened. Most people didn't.
Right. And, you know, our friend, my favorite of the original 13 states/colonies, Rhode Island.
I was like, this
those is... Punks,
those punks.
That never want to play along. You know, it didn't really matter what they had to say about it because they didn't even show up to the, what do you call it, ratification?
The Continental Congress.
Right. Well, I think they showed up to the Continental Congress. They didn't show up to the whatever.
Yeah, the ratification or.
Right, whatever that proceeding
the coup,
was called.
You can call
the
it.
The coup, yes. They didn't show up to the coup to ratify the coup. But it didn't matter because everyone else
ratified
agreed that they don't need to be there. We're just going to do it anyway. Just like how they kicked Charles I out of the courtroom and said, well, it doesn't matter if you agree or not. We're going to kill you.
Right. So, and that's just interesting. Now, I think, you know, I can already hear some grumbling about this because I talked about something similar before. And I oftentimes will get told, well, no, Joe, you don't understand. See, our laws were written by the people and approved by the people, and they get their authority from the people.
TM.
TM. Okay. Who are the people? especially back then, it wasn't everybody. It was mainly just property-owning men, you know. So those of you who that matters to, you know, there's enough for you to be triggered by that. But it was less than a quarter of the population, I would say. Or maybe a little. It was less than half, for sure. But I would say it's even less than a quarter. I don't know the exact statistics. But when you look at what it took to actually own land back then, and the fact that women were completely excluded, yeah, it was a minority of people that made this decision. But this minority of people commanded armies. And that's what essentially gave them the ability to do that, is force, you know. And while I do think that laying out laws, I think the main purpose that is being served by legal authority, it's a way to docilate the masses. You know, it seems fair. You know, we'll tell you what we can do to you and what will cause us to do things to you and exercise force against you. So at least, you know, and it was a step up from the way things had been before, you know, where you could just...
Well, and also just like what Charles I attempted to do and failed, a way to, what's the word that I want? Oh goodness. Basically a way to make people back down from their threats. There's a fancy word I'm looking for, but I can't think of it.
Concede?
No. Subdue, I think, is the word that I want to okay. Subdue people who would go up against it and say, well, you can't do this. It's not written down that you can.
Right.
Watch me though.
Yeah. And even though, you know, you fast forward to, you know, the more American philosophy on it, where theoretically you can do anything except these things. That was another big change.
That's an English law thing, actually.
Okay, an English law thing, yeah. Because before it was, you can do the following things. Well, actually, before that, it was just don't piss off the king. Right. Don't piss off the monarch or people that had bigger gun / bigger sword, people with
bigger
armor.
Stick, whatever. Yeah.
Bigger stick, yeah.
Depending on how far back we want to go.
Just don't piss that person off and you can do it, pretty much.
Right.
And we moved.
Right, but one of the key defining things of English common law is whatever is not forbidden is permitted.
Right.
For regular citizens. And it's the opposite for the government.
Exactly. Now, that was somewhat of an improvement, but in reality, though, I mean, does anyone honestly believe that the government won't do things? That it's not, like what is, that to me is the problem, is the fact that the government can only do these things, says who? The government, who gets to interpret, because, I mean, even look at the American system. The government has the ability to create, approve, remove laws, and also one of the branches of government can even be the one who interprets the law to be whatever they want it to be. You know, I mean, granted, there are some of these things that are a little more ludicrous than others, but I mean, the Supreme Court could come out tomorrow and say, well, when they said the right to bear arms, they mean the right to literally own the animal bear's arms. Like, they could change what that word meant if they felt like it.
Right.
And it seems ludicrous, but that's perfectly within their ability.
Right. And legally speaking, that's totally legitimate.
Yeah. And then it would become legitimate. And no one voted for that. You know, granted, we vote to put people there to make those decisions, but when you add on top of that the fact that there are only two political parties at any given time, and they themselves are institutions that are motivated to stay in power, I mean, what really can the average person do about that? You know, like if I had a problem, and this is something I think you see a lot. When I talk to people who are also involved in the Libertarian Party, you know, the sobering realization is that there is no clout because no one cares about the Libertarian Party, really. Not enough to make any real difference. And even if there were enough people, it's the resources that come from that. And there's only one entity that can legally just take resources and allocate them how they want to, and that's the government, you know. And so, like, there's really nothing stopping a party that has control of all three branches from just disbanding the other party. Now, there is one factor that keeps this all in check. And if we go back to our Charles I example, it's where these people in the House of Commons actually got their authority in the first place, and that's popular sovereignty. You know, if you get enough people behind you and people willing to wield arms, then yeah, you can do that. Doesn't matter what authority you're legally given. If you know, that's what a coup is. That's what a revolution is. It's people taking up arms against their government and doing it differently. But even then, now you're back to bigger stick diplomacy. Or, in, you know, if we talk about the boog, it's bigger gun diplomacy. And that's why so many people feel the way they do about the Second Amendment, is that's really the only way for the average person to keep the government in check, is by exerting your own force back, and or at least the threat, you know. And it's actually interesting. I got into a discussion with someone on Reddit, and this was actually a good discussion. I was surprised. The person was trying to square the philosophy of violence is the supreme authority through which all other authority is derived. That saying, I've probably been watching too many Sargon of Akkad videos, but or reading too much Robert Heinlein, but he was trying to square that with the NAP, right? Mm-hmm. Like, how do those things square up? You know, because the NAP says don't be aggressive. And one of the thoughts I had about that is, you know, even Heinlein talked about, it's not so much like Robert Heinlein put it, that the threat of violence is violence, right? It's pretty much one and the same. If you can make someone do something else with physical ability, whether you actually have to use it or not is irrelevant. You know?
Right.
And the NAP even sees it the same way. The NAP talks about threats the same way it talks about actually committing
violence.
Right.
If I threaten you with a weapon to make you do something, that's still coercion. That's aggression.
It's, exactly. And so he was trying to square those two things together. Now, that might be a discussion for a different time, how those two things square together. But when you put that in the context of what we're talking about in this example, you know, the fact that the average person is able to wield, in the United States, we're talking about firearms, but even at the time of Charles I, it's swords, you know.
They had firearms.
Swords and firearms. Okay. Okay. I'm showing my ignorance here because I don't exactly remember how far back this was. It's kind of irrelevant, but I mean, still arms. Just,
yes.
We'll use the catch-all term. The fact that the average person was able to wield arms, own them, first of all, and then wield them, bear them, if you will, is what kept that in check, you know? And really, there's no, I mean, it doesn't matter what the law was. The people in that House of Commons were breaking the written law. I mean, the folks that, in the American Revolution, the American revolutionaries were breaking the law to do
obviously
this.
It's treason, yeah.
Yeah, it's literal treason, but it's not seen that way because they won, you know? It was seen as a...
History is written by the victors.
Essentially, yeah.
That's why.
You know, and in the same thing could very well happen today. I think the written law is just, there's no authority, I think. It's just a justification. It's just a way of saying, you know, we all tacitly agree to this. Whether you do or not, as long as the majority tacitly agrees to what's written down, then they won't. It does, like you said, subdue the threat of not just, you know, other factions in the government, but the people abroad from taking up arms and doing something about it, you know. And I just think that is super interesting. Plus, you also see things happen all the time. Like, how many people has the U.S. government just drone striked in the last couple of months? Just because it could, you know? No one voted for that. I'm pretty sure that's illegal, you know, but it's all ambiguous. And another example I want to point out is, you know, we're dealing with all the impeachment garbage right now. And it's ended pretty much. But when you look at, I remember watching, you know, some commentary on what was happening, and the articles of impeachment were written up, and then they were just held by the House for a few days. And I was like, can they do that? And no one knew. Like, I think it's the biggest facade ever. I honestly believe that most of the people that actually sit in our government, in the Congress, don't actually know what the rules are. They don't.
Well, they're not written. That's the problem, is yeah. that it's written in the Constitution that impeachment is a thing and it has to be approved by these folks, but that's all it says. And and I think it's intentionally vague.
Yeah. But even then, but when you have that vagueness, who actually gets to say what it is? Like, the House could say, well, this means that we can hang on to these as long as we want and drop them whenever.
Yep.
The Senate could say, no, you can't. Who gets to decide? You know, and say it goes to the Supreme Court, which tends to be the tiebreaker for things like this when it comes to the law. now the Supreme Court can make up whatever they want, you know, and just, and those people aren't even elected, you know, they just get to decide what it is, you know? And then there's also this fun little fact that the president could just say no. Like, I don't think it's ever happened, but what do you really think would happen if the Senate, if the House squeaked out an impeachment, the Senate approved it, and the president just said, nah.
Meh.
I mean, we do have examples of that happening, not impeachment, but of that kind of thing
right,
happening.
Congress giving an order to the president and the president blatantly ignoring it.
Yeah, I mean, one of the biggest examples is, I mean, I personally like the guy. Like, I think he's kind of a baller, but it doesn't mean he's not an authoritarian. But Andrew Jackson, that defined his presidency. Hey, I'm picking up all of these Indians and I'm moving them out to Oklahoma. The Congress said, no, that's illegal. And then the Supreme Court said, yeah, that's illegal. You can't do that. And the literal quote that he said, I think it was Marshall at the time, that was the Supreme Justice, or what do they call it? The highest,
the
Chief Justice.
Chief Justice, yeah.
Yeah, I think Chief Justice, was maybe John Marshall or something. I don't remember his exact name.
Sure.
But he pretty much, and he said, that person has made his decision. Now let's watch him enforce it. And he pretty much just called the bluff on the whole situation. He said, go ahead. Stop me. You can't. Because I'm the person that commands the military and everything. So he just ordered it to happen anyway, and
nothing happened.
And the trail of tears. There you right. go. Like, then it just happened. And did he get impeached? Nope. He just blatantly said no. And, I mean, you even see that happen with citizens as well. You know, the whole ranchers revolt up in Montana, where these ranchers were letting their cattle graze on federal land. The federal government said, don't do that. Ranchers said, stop me. And there was a couple of standoffs, but ultimately whoever just stood their ground won. And it was going to come down to massacring a bunch of ranchers or just letting them do it. And if these ranchers didn't have guns, it'd have been a lot easier, but they did. You know, they just armed up, and no one really hears about that. You know, no one really knows about that these days. And it's just I think I look at that as an example of how you can kind of do whatever you want if you're armed. You know what I'm saying? Like, in the short term, sure, but in some cases even have lasting effects.
Right. It just depends on how many people you can get behind you. Even if they don't have to actually take up arms with you, as long as you have majority public support, you can probably get away with it.
Right. And you can even threaten future public outrage over it. You know, like, I think the ranchers in Montana even were talking about, we don't actually have to fire a shot. If they shoot at us, if they kill us,
there's going to be outrage.
There's going to be outrage. And that's enough to threaten the government. Because the government, I think, is aware that all it takes is the threshold for the number of people needed to have a problem with it, to the point where they're willing to take up arms, not even half the population, not even a quarter of the population. It's a relatively small percentage is the critical mass point for it to just flash, and then everything changes. And so it's all about maintaining this, you know, via through propaganda or through ceremony and tradition, you know, it's all about maintaining this facade that you really can't do anything, or you already have that ability, so don't worry about it. You know, I mean, it's ludicrous when you really think about it, how our government and democracy is essentially held together by people looking the other way, you know, and I don't know, it's just fascinating to me, you know. I think another great example of that, and again, this goes back to Historia Civilis. If you watch some of his stuff on Rome, it's super fascinating how seriously the Romans took the written law. Like, one of the biggest examples I could think of was, it's the episode where he talks about one of the emperors trying to bring elephants into the city.
Mm.
But he couldn't fit them through. Like, there's these two bollards that represent where the wall used to be before Rome expanded. And the rule was that you have to enter the city through one of these, air quotes, gates. Now they're just two posts.
Right.
And
they could easily walk around it, but you just don't do that.
Yeah, because if you do, you're legally invading.
Right.
You also can't bring weapons in. Like all of the people in the Senate and anyone who held military office, as soon as you walk out of the gates, you can pick up your weapons. But when you want to come in, you have to turn in your weapons and pick up this bundle of sticks that represents your authority. But it's just a representation of the military might you wield, not the actual might itself. There's no one there. Like, there's no one to really stop you from going around this bollard or, you know, carrying a sword in. But everyone had bought so hard into the fact that the law was the law that they just didn't do it, you know. Another example is when they all go out to vote on the fields of Mars. Like, everyone, when they go do their voting, it's very much like a caucus. You go all out and stand in this big field and move around when you vote. So the whole city, there's this mass exodus to go out here and vote. They will all cram through these tiny little spaces, even though there's plenty of room around it. And it's all in your head. It's all this, it's just this unwritten custom that everyone just knows. And that's what kept that society functioning. You know, it's literally ruled by memes, if you really think about it.
Right.
And I think that's as just as true today, you know? Like when you watch these First Amendment audit folks go out, you know, it's super interesting to watch, because on the one hand, you see this guy, you know, this ANCAP or this libertarian or so and such, and he's standing on a street corner near a federal building or something like that, and that arises suspicion. So when people come out to check it, he cites the law at them. But you can tell that everyone else there's usually this look amongst each of them where they're like, yeah, but
what are you doing?
But what are you doing? You know what I mean? It's in that moment, the law is irrelevant. Like, if you really think about it, the law only really matters in a courtroom.
Right.
And even then, it's only because that's a secure area where there is a person who can control. I think it's an actually great example. When you walk into any courtroom in the United States, there's usually only one or two people in there with guns. Like, police officers, I don't think, are supposed to be allowed to carry their guns.
Right, only either the designated officer, the bailiff. I.e. the bailiff, yes. Yeah.
And the bailiff is only beholden to one person in that courtroom.
The judge.
That judge, the only reason the law matters there is because the judge, who is the arbiter of that law, can do literally anything he wants in just within the confines of that small room. And people put him there to arbitrate the law fairly. You know, that's just wild. You know, and I've seen people get put in jail for months for no crimes committed just because they're held in contempt, which the judge can do at any time for any reason. He can just hold you in contempt and put you in jail. And you'll sit there and rot for months. No crime, nothing, just because the judge says so. But he has totally unchecked authority in that room.
Right.
I mean, the only checks that he has is another judge on a different level than him, you know. But that's just fascinating to me that it doesn't really matter what the law says, you know? It does and it doesn't, I think. What do you think about that? Like, do you think the written law actually matters, or is there a scenario in which it actually matters, or is it just people tacitly just agreeing to go along with it that, and if you say you had two parties, right? And one of them cites the law at the other one. I think the law is only effectual if both people agree that they're both going to follow the law. Then they create a framework to deal with themselves in. But if one person just says no, you know, in that moment, does the law even matter?
I think that it can. It depends on what you mean by matter. You know, because, at least in Western civilization, the law is, at least in a roundabout way, determined by popular opinion,
mm-hmm.
That if one party cites the law against the other and the other blatantly goes against it, then there is popular support against them. And so this can be wielded as a threat.
Mm-hmm.
So it matters in the sense that you can get results from it still.
Right. That leads to a different thing, though, now that I think about it.
That's sort of that. I mean, really, all of this comes from the thing that we talked about in our first episode on authority, in which we defined authority in a unconventional way of an authority is a currency that can be used to achieve power. And so legal authority fits this definition in that so long as people respect it, then you can wield it as power.
Right. Now, is it... Yeah, okay, I see what you're saying. That gives me an interesting thought about the decay of the rule of law. Let me give you a good example. Let's say I break the law, technically. I violate some law.
Sure.
But I'm doing so for a reason that the popular opinion would be positive, right? Now, through the legal loophole known as jury nullification, I could be taken to court, prosecuted for breaking that law, and as long as my peers, at least actually, as long as one person on that bench agrees with me, I can walk free. And the law is essentially ineffectual at that point.
Right.
Now, that whole topic's a topic by itself. You know, I think CGP Great is a good video on jury nullification. However, I think just by mentioning it, I think I just...
Right. By the way, everyone listening to this show, you are no longer eligible for jury duty. You're welcome.
Yeah, you're welcome. Sorry. And also, what's the disclaimer? We are not legal professionals. We are not offering legal advice in any way, shape, or form. So do not make legal decisions based on what we say in this video. There you go. So we disclaimed ourselves.
And also, we definitely do not ever, and it has never been alleged of us, that we commend nullifying the law by way of jury. But
right. Yes.
This has never been alleged, ever.
Never been alleged.
Moving on.
Moving on. But let's just say that it does happen. And this is just a more complicated version of... I mean, this happens in other places too, but juries can nullify laws. Prosecutors can essentially nullify laws by just refusing to prosecute people for breaking certain laws. A good example is if you look in sanctuary cities, or sanctuary anything, this is the terms being used now, prosecutors will just refuse to prosecute people on the basis of certain laws.
Yep.
And then it goes even further down than that to the police officer or the officer of some rank of authority refusing to just arrest you for that law. And
right, the prosecutor can say, go apprehend this person for trial. And the sheriff can say,
nah,
I'm good.
And you're kind of seeing that in Virginia right now with the whole Boog situation, is that there are a bunch of local police that are just refusing to arrest people for violating this law. Or they say they will not do it. So there are like at least three levels. There are at least three levels we've just listed where there is one person can just say no and just not deal with that law anymore. And there's really no one else that can do anything about it. And what I'm talking about when I start saying decay is the whole point. If any law I feel like is starting to be treated this way, it damages that authority currency for the entire system.
Exactly.
And I think this only gets exacerbated and is worse when more laws are just being created, but no laws are ever taken off the books. You know, I mean, I forget the statistic, but there are supposedly each person in the United States, every citizen breaks the law every day because of just how many laws on all the different levels that exist.
Right. Not just laws, but felony offenses.
Right.
The number that I have heard that was written about in a book whose title and author I cannot recall immediately, is that the average American citizen unwittingly commits 3 felony offenses a day.
Yeah. But nothing happens to them for it.
Right.
But as so often we see, it depends if someone wants to get you or not.
Exactly. The law is so convoluted that you unwittingly commit offenses. And so then if somebody with the power to put you in a courtroom decides they don't like you, then they have some dirt on you.
Yeah, and they can call that up and selectively try you. And that's one of my biggest beefs with almost any legal system that exists. There is no law that says that prosecutors have to prosecute. They are given discretion. There is no law that says police officers must arrest you or must detain you and issue citations to you. And there's no law that says that the person on the jury has to follow the law, because that would kind of defeat the whole point of the jury, you know? Right. And all of this...
Right. If someone else can just disagree with the jury's decision, why have the jury?
Exactly. And I know why all these things exist. We give discretion at almost every level because, well, one, it would be impossible for every police officer out there, like the system could not bear it if every police officer, every prosecutor alone, just those two people who are in the positions of authority consistently, they're not just randomly selected to be in a position of authority at time. They're actually, that's their job. If they had to arrest every single person, the police, that committed any crime on any book that was subject to that individual, and then the prosecutor had to try them, we would all be in jail. Like, we would all be going through prosecution, even the people carrying out those rules. It's just impractical. And we give that discretion to allow them to, you know, for everything to function. But at the same time, like you said, all it takes is you pissing off that prosecutor's, you know, say you're a young lad, you know, around 18 years old, and you start dating the prosecutor's daughter or whatever, and then you break up with her. He could all of a sudden decide that you need to be watched closer. If he felt like it, just because of a personal malice, could just decide that, you know what, talk to the sheriff, keep an eye on him. And then when he breaks the law, go ahead and arrest him for it. And then I'm going to try him for it. Even though that same sheriff could watch dozens of other people break that same law and just let it slide. Ah, that's a pretty extreme example, but it happens. You know, I know for a fact that it happens. I've seen plenty of people who, just based on their social currency, if you will, and standing in the community, people don't like him. They think he's a jerk. But that's all that's really been ascribed to him. And that's not against the law to be a jerk. But there are plenty of things that he does do that breaks the law that everyone else does. But all of a sudden, because everyone thinks he's a jerk, he's going to start getting arrested for it. You know what I mean?
Right.
And it's all legal at that point. But that all that kind of activity, like selective enforcement, I think, is just a broad umbrella we can put over that. That's selective enforcement, which is exacerbated by having just way too many laws on the books to even keep track of. So much so that you need to pay someone tens, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars to keep up with it for you when you do end up in court. Lawyer fees. Like, there's a whole profession around sorting all this out, you know, for right. individuals. No one takes the law seriously at that point. It just weakens that integrity. And I think the reason we see these problems get worse and exacerbated with time is because more laws keep getting added, nothing gets removed. And it gets to the point where it's just this bloated system that can't function. And not only that, but that authority currency we talked about, the legitimacy that's in the minds of the people that go along with it begins to wane. And once you reach that critical mass, no one takes it seriously anymore, you know. And you've even seen, and I think one of the best examples of watching this happen in local instances, look at these Antifa-controlled areas, like in Portland, Oregon. These people openly break the law every day, but because no one's going to stop them, and because when the police try to intervene, it gets worse, the jig is up, like called the bluff, you know, and so they're able to get away. And regardless of whether I agree with these people's opinions on what they believe, and I don't condone their actions, it's just phenomenal to watch these people just do whatever they want because they have enough people. They've bought into the consciousness of, you know, what enough people that are going to act would do. And because, and it's then the moment you don't get arrested for that, and the moment you get away with that, like if I bash someone's skull with a bike lock and then people figure out who I was and I'm still not prosecuted, it just weakens that currency even more, you know? So I think my thought on legal legitimacy or the legal authority or written authority, it's only as good as the number of people that buy into it, just like any other meme. As long as right. people...
And this is the nature of authority in general.
It's just the nature of authority in general. So yeah, that's... doesn't matter if you're a king, even, it seems. As long enough people think that's right, and you have someone who's willing to, in that day and age, pick up the axe, and no one stop him and let him get away with it, you could be executed, you know? And that's kind of terrifying to think about. But at the same time, it also, I think, really shows how close at any given time we are to a boog, to put it simply.
Right. Truly revolutionary ideas.
Indeed. Literally. What are your thoughts on that? Is that, do you think that's a good thing? Is it just an observation on this, the reality of the situation?
I think it's an observation on the reality of the situation. I mean, it is a good thing, you know, that there is at the very least this the ray of hope that if, you know, that legal authority only represents as much power as people buy into it, and if enough people don't, then it can be overridden even in the most dire of circumstances.
And I think at that point you just have to deal with, I mean, at that point, aren't we just at the mercy of the tyranny of the masses at that point, though? I mean, technically we already are, but that's it's just blatant at that point.
Right, but that's how it is.
It is how it is. Do you think we'll ever reach a time, because I have my own problems with the tyranny of the masses, you know, like I do.
Sure, yeah.
I don't necessarily like the way, you know, legal systems work. I will acknowledge that it can serve the function of preventing just popular opinion from having its way when I would disagree with it.
You put these barriers in there where you make a system that in most people's eyes is better than just having to go get the torches and rakes whenever something happens that you don't like.
Right.
You make a system for it, and so long as everyone buys into the system, then things happen peacefully, quote unquote.
Right. Well, at that point, it's just consensual violence.
Right.
By the populace. Not the individual, probably, who has the violence enacted against them, but the populace has consent for them.
Right. But I mean, I can get behind that. I mean, because in a way, you know, we are better off in a system where it is frowned upon and will be acted against for your neighbors to just decide they don't like you and go drag you out and kill you.
Right. Yeah, I would tend to agree. Like, I had this, I mean, thanks to Historia Civilis again, I had this fascination with the Roman legal system. It really was fascinating to me to watch just your average citizen just be so politically engaged. And everyone, and granted, the laws were a lot simpler back then. There were a lot fewer of them. So the average person could understand and be involved. Like, it was very common for the average person to be able to stand for themselves in defense during a trial. You didn't need a lawyer. You could do it yourself if you were well-read enough. And it was not unachievable. Most people the only people that were actual lawyers were the people who served in the Senate. And that was their job, to act on the behalf of the state as the form of a lawyer and be embodiment of the state in a courtroom. But I think maybe that's the allure for me, is the fact that everyone buys into this because the buy-in rate of the citizenry was so high. Like, so many people had bought into the system, mixed with the fact that it was far less complicated than modern legal systems, and the added benefit that, you know, it's a lot more localized, meant that, you know, you don't have to worry about the tyranny of the masses as much. I mean, they eventually did, and that's what led to the fall of Rome, the whole bread and circuses thing. Right. But just the average person could defend themselves in a framework that everyone knew the rules. So even if you disagreed with, you know, the moral standpoint of where a law came from, you at least knew that everyone would be held to that standard. You could hold anyone to that same standard and it wouldn't be selectively applied, you know. And I don't know how we could move closer to a system like that, because I do agree it is much better than just mob rule and madness. You know, that's how you get, you know, that's how you get the kulaks getting thrown in gulags, you know.
Right.
That's just mob rule, where everyone just says, you know what, that guy has slightly, he used to be poor like me, but now he's essentially a poverty apostate, and he made a little money, now he owns some land. You know, let's throw that guy in the gulag just because we don't like him, you know, and then we're going to take his stuff because we need stuff. That's way less preferable, but, you know, it's not perfect to have a system where everyone can still effectually do that, as long, I think it just raises the bar for the number of people you need to kind of be on your side about it. Now, do you think this only holds up as long as one person, like, because the thought that I inevitably would have is, what if we all had McNukes, you know, like, is this only an occurrence of the fact that numbers usually win in any kind of forced dispute? You know, like, is that because just to go back to the Rome example, back in the Roman days, it really was just number of warm bodies you could throw at a problem, you know?
Sure.
I mean, granted, there is, even in that time, you could offset that by having you would probably rather have a few hundred trained soldiers that had gear as opposed to a few thousand just hungry peasants. But even then, you know, the few thousand hungry peasants can fight pretty hard. You know, and then as we move forward, it's the playing field gets a little more level with each leap in technology. You know, I mean, when you look at, for example, the controversy surrounding the 5.7 cartridge because its ability to penetrate body armor. No citizen had that problem because most citizens don't wear body armor every day. The people who were in positions of authority, like the police, had a problem with that because now
they can be shot too.
You can get shot too. And just as lethally as you shooting at the average citizen. So now, and then you throw
in, they don't like not having the upper hand.
Exactly. Yeah. And I don't think governments ever not like having the upper hand.
Right.
Because when the capability of the average person to handle a threat increases, then the effectiveness of any type of actual, you know, force, police force, the military, is diminished in a relative scope. And so, I mean, if you take that to its logical extreme, you know, I think there's already examples of this going on, but if you take it to a logical extreme where everyone had a nuke, it doesn't matter at that point. Like, it doesn't matter what that person says to me. It's like, what are you going to do? You know, and take that and then also take the mental instability, which is why also we fear terrorists, especially the type that, you know, when you look at the Al-Qaeda and our problems with that, was that it doesn't matter how much force you can exert on this person. That person is willing to die for it. You know, now all of a sudden you're dealing with a totally different kind of enemy.
Right, you're in a different paradigm now.
Yeah, that person will not submit. That person will suicide bomb themselves before they're, you know, before they're willing to get arrested or just be shot. And that's terrifying for that reason alone, that it's like a caged animal or like a cornered animal.
There is no diplomacy. You can't argue with this person enough.
Right. Well, and I don't even think it's that you can't argue with this person enough. It's that
you can't threaten them enough.
You can't threaten them enough. They're prepared to die. You the person issuing the threats likely doesn't want to die because you're trying to disarm the situation with the threat of violence. But if the other person doesn't care,
you know what? I'm willing to die, and if I'm going to die, I might as well take you out with me.
Right. And that's terrifying to the people that don't want to die, you know? And that's what makes it such an effective terrorist strategy, is it really does strike fear in the hearts of people because I don't want to die. And because I don't want to die, I have the lower hand in this engagement just right from the get-go, because they're putting it, regardless of what their technology is and what they can do, the fact that they're willing to go farther than I am puts me at a disadvantage. I've talked about this, and there's a much less extreme example of this when it comes to like real life personal interactions. I call it people holding situations hostage for that reason. Just to do a quick offshoot. Have you ever been in a situation where you're trying to, you and two other people are having just a discussion, and then one of the people is perfect, has no shame, we'll say, and they're willing to just make a mockery of themselves, but also drag you down with them, making that mockery of themselves, right? In the eyes of the third person, you know. Those are just the worst kind of people, you know. Or say you're trying to, like, I'm trying to organize a small get together for this friend, but I have this other friend who, if it doesn't go their way, will just tell everybody off and use the fact that they're an emotional wreck to just negatively affect the moods of everybody else. And they don't care about that. you know, they have no shame. They don't care about anyone else. They would be willing to watch everyone else have a bad time just so they're not the only one having a bad time.
Essentially, your misery loves company person.
Right.
I hate those people that do that. And that's a much less extreme example, but they tend to get what they want. And that it reinforces that behavior. I've seen, you know, because they're willing to just go all out and ruin everyone else's. It's like, I don't care that I have a good time. I just don't want everyone else having a good time. And it's that, you know, just to make a more mild example, just a weird offshoot. Sorry.
Right. Well, yeah, that happens. That is especially, potent in family dynamics. Which is why so many people hate their relatives, because
yep.
you've at least got that one person who is like that, and that you can't get rid of, mm-hmm. because they're family, you know, because enough other people in the family, you know, believe in family magic and keep them around, that you find yourself being unwilling to do certain things because family member X will make your life hell for it.
Right. And it's all because they're willing to give up being happy themselves. And so that's a purely social animal dynamic. You know, that does not incur in creatures that don't have social structures. That person that creature just gets eaten or left out to die.
Right.
But because we're compassionate, people can leverage that compassion or empathy into authority just by willing to go lower. You know, so yeah, this is just a different slice of the same thing, but I think it really does get back to the problem of why we deal with these issues as human beings. Is real demagoguery is not the person that can convince a bunch of other people to do what they want. It's the person who is willing to sacrifice everything at the expense of other people to get other people to do what they want. That's the real demagoguery problem, you know. But to go back to our example of what if everyone had a McNuke? There's already an example of this. North Korea still exists for one reason. And it's not their Chinese backers, it's not their Russian backers, or whatever anyone wants to say. The pure and simple of it is they have nukes. Like, that's why they exist. You know, I firmly believe. And it, because you look at what goes on in North Korea, no one likes that. There is just a tyrannical leader who can do whatever he wants to his people, but because he has a nuke, you know, if you look at the power level of the North Korean state, if you were to count the number of, in any metric, they are far dwarfed by some place like the United States of America, right?
Right.
But it doesn't matter. It's just like you could have the most body armored out, well-trained SWAT police officer, but if homie at home has a claymore, it doesn't matter. You know what I mean? It doesn't matter. It equalizes the force, you know? And what would that look like? You know, if everyone... Okay, I'll ask two questions. Do you think that we'll ever get to a point where numbers are now irrelevant? And two, if we do get to that point, is democracy even feasible? Since democracy exists on the fact that by having the popular opinion, you can exert authority through the threat of bringing to bear the populace against the other person.
I think that numbers will always matter. You can increase the threshold that you know, of the number you have to matter, but there will be some point at which enough people can get together and win in a situation like that.
I think in the foreseeable future, yes, but I actually think in the distant future, if we don't, you know, nuke ourselves as a species, I think you might be right, but I think the dynamic is different. It's for a different reason. I think it has more to do with the fact that the quality of life that we all come to expect as of now is unachievable without
a multitude of individuals. So, like, just to provide an example, it may not matter that, like, I could have, let's just say, like, let's take the whole violence part out of it and just look at the threat the market can impose by itself. You know what I'm saying? And this is another reason why it doesn't even take anywhere near a majority of people to make a difference. I think, you know, the authority comes from the market as well, in the ability for an individual to meet demand. So let's take this as an example. Let's just say, and I think this is a problem that people have right now with, you know, big tech companies, right? Jeff Bezos could theoretically do things that the average person couldn't do, not just because of his wealth, but because of the impact he commands over the market. For example, he can, without wielding a weapon, make or break an entire industry sector by just refusing to service it on Amazon. And essentially what he's doing is leveraging his ability, because he to control the market in a certain way to do that, right? If you want to take it back to, like, the small town example, we talked about this example many times before, where I don't have to hold a gun to your head to make you do something. I don't have to even have to hold a gun to your head to make you stop doing something. And you could see kind of this, how this happened. I think one of the biggest realizations for how this can happen in the Soviet Union. Sure, you can lock up all the kulaks, but that's really short-sighted. Because now where is your food going to come from? Because guess what? You just locked up everybody who knew how to grow food on a mass level, right? And then I think you just start dealing with the problem of short-sightedness, which, let's be honest, mob rules tend to be very short-sighted.
Right.
They just hate the thing that's in front of them right now, but they don't realize that if, you know, we're gonna go ahead and lock you all in gulags now because we're mad about it, and then when we start starving 3 months later, blame something else. You know, but I think if we as a populace were a little more forward thinking, and by that I mean just, like, look into the future and see what would happen, right? That I think also serves as a protection as well from authority, you know. I don't know how that works in, like, a post-scarcity environment where you can essentially just automate everything, and once you buy the automaton that can replicate, well, you could effectively be a one-man production. But even then, I think the last and final is the fact that the same thing that makes us social enough to form groups and wield that authority is the same reason that individuals can still be affected without force. You know, and that we've talked about social, the social way to change people's behavior that's allowed by the NAP. Every single human being needs to have other human interactions. It is a physical requirement for most people to interact with other people because we're social creatures. If not, your mental health will really start to struggle, right?
Right.
So one of the biggest factors beyond violence to make a person do anything is to keep people, to keep from being shamed, essentially. Like, shame is such a powerful tool, social tool for human beings. And that's why, you know, I think we talked about it before, how useful shame is. And there are ups and downs to it because, you know, you can be shamed by one person and it be enough sometimes. But, I mean, that's how some of these activist groups get what they want, is they lay shame at the feet of someone who has authority. And that person changes their mind because they're being shamed. So I don't know that force will always be necessary. I think it really depends on kind of how we continue to evolve as social creatures. But I think maybe in the short term, democracy is probably the best. A limited democracy, you know, with a legal system a part of it, is the best way to deal with it. I think that the problem comes about when people realize that that's all farcical. They don't actually need to follow it. But then how do you get back to that system? You know, how do you deal with that? You know, I think one way to mitigate it, obviously, is to take the law seriously, but that's much more easily achieved by having fewer of them, you know, having fewer laws.
Right. And ones that people find reasonable.
But you know, if history has served any examples, I feel like that never happens. I feel like governments will be more willing to just go ahead and collapse, and you see revolution and it starts a new government and you just wipe the slate clean. I think that's kind of, you know, if you look at the template for democracies, that seems to just kind of be how it goes. You know, a new democracy is formed with very few laws on the books. And
because the books are brand new.
The books are brand new and everything kind of stabilizes. Well, as the democracy gets older, it starts dealing with more and more situations that it feels like it has to create a law to deal with. You know, precedent has to become a thing, but no laws ever get redacted. People start realizing that because these laws aren't being obeyed or followed, they don't take it seriously. And then that number just keeps increasing. And then before you know it, you reach a critical mass. There is a revolution and now you start over. And that the old government's gone, but a new government's in place and the whole system just starts over again.
Yep.
So, final thoughts on legal authority, maybe a necessary evil or just an observation of one of the better ways for us to deal with groups of people or deal with people by looking at them as a group.
It's one of the better ways.
Sure.
Yeah.
Do you think there is a better way than that?
There could be. That's a topic for another time.
It's a topic for another time. I think that's a good way to end the segment. All right. Until next time, I guess. Philosophers.
Philosophers.